This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Muslim pilgrims converge in large numbers in the Iraqi city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Iran rejects claims by the Israeli Prime Minister against the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. And North Korea defends its right to self-defense and weapons tests while criticizing what it calls the U.S. hostile policy towards Pyongyang. Thank you for joining us. With our top story, crowds of Muslim pilgrims are in the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate the day of Arba'in. The annual occasion is one of the world's biggest religious gatherings. It marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The pilgrims, most of them Iraqis, have walked to Karbala where Imam Hussein is buried. Security is beefed up in and around the city. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims to several 10,000. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with a tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Muslims in large numbers have come together in the holy city of Karbala to observe the day of Arba'in, which marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein and his companions almost 1,400 years ago in the Battle of Karbala. Every year, millions of pilgrims take the journey to the holy city of Karbala to mark the event. But this year, due to the coronavirus pandemic, the Iraqi government has restricted that number to several 10,000. On the day of Arba'in, pilgrims gather together, usually beat their chests, and mark the event of Arba'in. Arba'in means 40, or the 40th day. 40 is a special number in most Islamic cultures. 40 is the usual length of mourning. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred at the hands of the troops of the tyrant ruler of their time, Yazid, almost 1,400 years ago, on the plain of Karbala. And then 40 days after their martyrdom, the survivors of the battle returned to Karbala to visit the tombs of Imam Hussein and his companions. Well, in the holy city of Karbala, there are two holy shrines that are in close proximity to one another. One is that of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third Shia Imam, and one it belongs to his brother, Abbas ibn Ali alayhi salam. Well, there is an area between the two holy shrines that is referred to as Bainul Haramain, which translates into between the two shrines in English. Usually pilgrims who come from different parts of the world, from Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, Syria, even as far as Nigeria, they travel on foot for 80 kilometers if they take that special route from the holy city of Najaf, where the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first Shia Imam, and Imam Hussein's father is located. They travel on foot for about 80 kilometers to arrive in Karbala and mark the day of Arba'in. Every year, including this year, I've just read it that about 14 million pilgrims have taken the journey to the Iraqi holy city of Karbala this year. But usually the crowd is larger than this. As I said, this year, because of the coronavirus pandemic, the number of foreign pilgrims has been limited to several 10,000. So most of the pilgrims that have come together in the Iraqi holy city of Karbala are Iraqis.
Muslims marked Arba'in, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arba'in procession. The Arba'in march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdul Azim Hassani.
Arba'in march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either canceled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still, after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arba'in, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arba'in is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran has lashed out at Israel after its Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused the Islamic Republic of crossing what he called red lines in its nuclear program. In a tweet, Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi, said Israel is in no position to discuss its called peaceful nuclear program when it has hundreds of nuclear warheads. Takht-e Ravanchi added, Bennett's speech was full of lies. During his UN General Assembly speech, Bennett vowed that Israel would not allow Tehran to acquire a nuclear weapon. He also urged a more concrete international effort to halt Iran's nuclear activities. His comments come as Tehran has time and again reiterated that its nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Investigative journalist Tony Gusseling believes there is nothing illegal about Iran's nuclear program, and Israel had better be worried about its own.
Well, I think with the nuclear conflict that's going on, in the Middle East, particularly between Iran and Israel, actually, there is actually nothing illegal or nothing contentious about the Iranians developing nuclear power. And we're constantly getting smears from the Israeli side saying, oh, actually, really what the Iranians want is nuclear weapons. Now, anyone that studies this knows that actually a fatwa was issued against nuclear weapons on moral grounds in Iran, about against their manufacture. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I mean, for us as peace campaigners here in Britain, since the 1950s and 60s, we have been against nuclear weapons on moral grounds. And it's great to see the Iranians actually going along with that. Now, the same is not true, I'm afraid, in Israel. Although in the Old Testament it says, thou shalt not kill, I mean, we realise that the nuclear bombs will kill, if they're used in anger, tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands of innocent people. And so I think the Israelis also should consider, through their faith, the idea that maybe this is not a good idea to pursue these weapons. As we know, the Israelis have, they believe anyway, something like 200 nuclear weapons. And anyway, even if the Iranians did have nuclear weapons, this it was proved in the Cold War to be actually quite a good thing to keep the balance of power, to stop a nuclear-armed country attacking a non-nuclear-armed country.
Tehran has dismissed as biased and false a claim by the International Atomic Energy Agency that it was barred from a nuclear site in Iran. Spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamal Vandi, also warned the IAEA against disrupting the cooperation with the Islamic Republic. On Sunday, the agency said its inspectors had been denied access to a centrifuge manufacturing site in the city of Karaj near the capital Tehran. Iran says the facility is exempt from an understanding reached with the IAEA earlier this month over servicing, monitoring, and surveillance equipment at Iranian nuclear sites. Russia also says denying the agency access to the site does not violate safeguards agreements. Iranian officials say the Karaj site was sabotaged in an attack in June, which is still being investigated by security and judicial authorities. North Korea's ambassador to the UN has called on the United States to give up its hostile stance toward his country. Kim Sung added, no one could deny his country's right to self-defense and the weapon tests. He made the remarks on the last day of the UN General Assembly, shortly after the South Korean military said the North had fired an unidentified projectile into its eastern waters. Kim demanded that the United States permanently stop its joint military drills with South Korea. Pyongyang has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missile programs in return for U.S. sanctions relief collapsed in 2019. Jennifer Chang says differences between North and South Koreas would not be resolved as long as the United States maintains its presence in the region.
Well, the South Koreans want very badly for the inter-Korean talks to resume, and the South Korean government has been holding out the olive branch. But the U.S. is here in South Korea. It's there in Japan, the U.S. troops, tens of thousands of them. And, of course, there are going to be weapons in and around the Korean Peninsula stationed not only in South Korea but in Japan and in the U.S. military base on Guam. So until those are permanently removed forever, the North is not going to engage in denuclearization talks that can have productive results. So this is why people are very nervous here in South Korea.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been hit with an egg white while visiting an international food trade fair in the southern city of Lyon. Macron was walking through the crowd when a man threw the boiled egg at him. The young protester was heard shouting, "Long live the revolution!" The French president's bodyguards later arrested the protester. In June, Macron was slapped in the face by a critic during a visit to southeastern France. That man was also arrested and sentenced to 4 months in prison. British authorities have put the military on standby to help deal with the ongoing fuel crisis as fear over tanker driver shortages has led to panic buying there. In a statement, the Energy Ministry's Department for Business said limited number of military tanker drivers are on a state of readiness and will be deployed if necessary to further stabilize fuel supply chain. This as shortage of tanker drivers has left many of the country's pumps dry. The shortage is due to new Brexit visa regulations as well as a COVID backlog.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel and but I've been trying several of them and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really, you know. I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country, so the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded. And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson said the residents of Hong Kong have their legal rights and freedom fully protected in accordance with law. On Friday, Beijing published a fact sheet on the U.S.'s interference in Hong Kong's affairs and its support for anti-China forces. But Washington claimed its actions were, quote, fully consistent with international law, and that the fact sheet undermined the city's appeal as a hub of openness and free exchange. China reacted by saying that the 102 items listed in the document were all based on clear facts and solid evidence. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
In recent years, the U.S. and its European allies have decreased the number of ground troops deployed overseas in the so-called War on Terror, turning instead to airstrikes, while their local partners carry out ground operations. This increasing reliance on aerial warfare, which renders nearly invisible the identity of the military force that kills a civilian, has made it all but impossible for civilians to get compensation for the loss of family members. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Pesha Majid Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Military Often Kills Civilians and Rarely Offers Compensation. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. In Iraq, where U.S. operations were primarily conducted by air, news reports suggest that only around 14 payments have been made since operations against Daesh began in 2014. In 2019, only 6 Iraqis received sympathy payments compared to the 605 payments issued in Afghanistan. In 2020, no sympathy payments were issued globally. Most ex-Gratia payments are small, usually between $2,500 and $5,000. One of the condolence payments issued in 2019 was only $131, with ex-Gratia payments being distributed in line with its counterterrorism interest. U.S. policy offers no clear means for civilians whose families have been killed and whose homes have been destroyed in bombing campaigns to seek restitution. Not only is there no clear pathway for civilians seeking compensation, but also, as Schill notes, even internationally recognized NGOs and human rights organizations have struggled to identify the right point of contact to bring cases or to request ex gratia payments. So given that, it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be a sole civilian in one of these countries already grieving from an unimaginable loss and then trying to figure out what to do next. For the U.S. European allies, the legal avenues to compensation vary. In the U.K., claims follow the guidelines of the Geneva Conventions, under which one can only file a civil claim for wrongful death if the person can prove that the harm to civilians was disproportionate to the military gain from whatever operation killed them. That basically means that unless it is an egregious case, it is very hard to prove that it was unlawful, and certainly without access to the decision-making process or the decision-making documentation, it is very hard to prove, says Mark Latimer of the Ceasefire Center for Civilian Rights, an organization that advocates for reparations for civilians. That's one of the reasons why successful cases, and there have been hundreds of successful cases, are all basically to do with abuses in detention, he adds. The detention cases occurred when UK ground forces were still fighting in Iraq, but once they limited their operations to bombings, civilians stopped having a route to compensation. In late April, the UK further entrenched legal barriers to compensation, passing the Overseas Operations Act, a law that sets the hard 6-year limit for anyone wishing to bring a civil harm against the UK's armed forces for acts committed overseas. The act started a ticking clock for civilians who might have legitimate claims that they are unaware of. The Overseas Operations Act is now basically an act to protect the government and the Ministry of Defense and the UK government from civil liability under the pretense of protecting veterans, says Latimer. The US and many of its allies use coalition operations as an excuse to weasel out of responsibility for civilian deaths that occurred during anti-ISIS operations in Iraq and Syria. An individual nation's airstrikes are attributed to the entire coalition, but the coalition states that members often share intelligence and coordinate on airstrikes. This complicates establishing the chain of responsibility, and while the coalition may say there is joint responsibility for a strike, it has no mechanism for addressing the harm, leaving it up to individual member states to take responsibility. Sahar Muhammad Ali, who has worked for more than 2 decades for CIVIC and is the current head of its West Asia region program, remembers advising coalition members and the Pentagon to create a joint standard operating procedure in the lead up to the war against ISIS. She says, "I'm being very honest with you. They said no. I mean, the UK, Australia, France, everybody said no." The UK, France and Belgium have refused to acknowledge any civilian casualties during the battle for Mosul, a claim experts find absurd. Chris Woods, the director of Air Wars, says, "You cannot bomb cities and towns without significant civilian harm. It's just not possible. And any belligerent that claims otherwise is in complete denial and is representing an entirely false picture to their home populations." On top of that, member nations of the coalition rarely investigate the civilian costs of their strikes. In 2017, at the height of the Battle of Mosul, the UK shuttered the team it had established in 2010 to investigate crimes committed during the Iraq War. Latimer says, as far as we are aware, the only team working on civilian casualties is the press office. Dutch media discovered that the Netherlands was responsible for an airstrike that killed at least 70 civilians in the Iraqi town of Hawija in 2015. This caused a massive scandal in the Netherlands, with lawmakers forced to address the issue in Parliament. The Netherlands announced a several million euro fund to reconstruct Hawija, but at least 50 civilians from the town are still actively seeking compensation. Zegveld, the Dutch lawyer, represents the civilians who were injured or lost relatives due to Hawija's strike. She is hopeful that they will receive compensation, but believes that the Dutch role in their plight would never have been public if not for media efforts. "That's the sad situation, that no one takes responsibility for anything, and there is no investigation into civilian casualties whatsoever," she says. "That's exactly what the coalition is doing behind the veil of their coordinated attacks. Everyone is responsible and no one is responsible. There will be no investigation into facts whatsoever, let alone recognition of liability," she says. The Hawija scandal was a large-scale disaster, but according to Woods of Air Wars, the great majority of civilian deaths in war occur in small-scale events, of which there are a very large number. "No one civilian killed here, two civilians killed there. Very low incident civilian harm, but which culminatively accounts for the majority of civilian deaths over the duration of conflict." On September 17th, the U.S. acknowledged that its drone strike in Afghanistan had killed seven civilians, calling it a tragic mistake. This admission came after intense media scrutiny that cases like Khazar's never receive. She has very few expectations that the killing for her son will receive such treatment. As far as she knows, no one has investigated the circumstances of his death, nor has anyone reached out to her. In all likelihood, no one ever will. Khazar knows this, noting, "Those who bomb don't compensate."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
uniform of a soldier. Part 2.
On the last day of the summer of 1980, on September the 22nd at 10 a.m., a report was received from Gilan-e-Gharb, a provincial city located in the western border of Iran, about the bombing of Iranian territory by the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. In the very early hours of the attack, it was not clear what had happened and what the exact scope of the attack was. At 1:30 p.m., reports of bombing reached Tehran from the western province of Ilam and the city of Dehloram. 15 minutes later, Ahvaz reported the airport had been bombed. 5 minutes after Ahvaz, at 1:50 p.m., Kermanshah reported a similar attack. 5 minutes later, at exactly 1:55 p.m., Bushehr also reported that it had been bombed. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Despul Air Force Base was also bombed. There was panic and chaos in the corridors of the Air Force. Everyone was wondering what was going on. Eyewitnesses had seen olive-colored MiGs flying in the Iranian airspace and dropping bombs. Twenty minutes had passed since the bombing of the Despul Air Force Base when the same olive-colored MiGs all appeared in the sky of Tehran. Black smoke rose from Mehrabad Airport. At that very moment, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was waiting to talk to the factory workers at the General Factory near Mehrabad Airport. At that moment, Ayatollah Khamenei decided not to cancel his speech for the factory workers. He calmly went behind the podium and gave them heart. Until then, Ayatollah Khamenei was dressed as a cleric, the clothes he wore since he was a teenager. But he did not know that fate had prepared another garment for him as well. This is the story of the presence of the leader of the Islamic Revolution during the early years of the imposed war on Iran, a depiction of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei in military uniform.
It was another small victory for the activists who are fully backed by their country's supreme ruler, the Ayatollah Khomeini.
At this opportunity, the greatest change came after the revolution.
The next move is evidently up to the United States.
With the Muslim student followers of Imam's Line Plan, the espionage headquarters of Iran's biggest enemy was captured. The interim government resigned after capturing the American embassy, referred to as the Den of Spies. In the months after the IRGC was established, the interim government did not play an effective role in assisting the IRGC. Now, the Revolutionary Council, in order to improve the quality of the IRGC, handed over the leadership of the IRGC to Ayatollah Khamenei on November the 24th, 1979. In the meantime, Ayatollah Khamenei called on the commander of the Western Corps, Mohammad Borujerdi, to create a connection with the Kurdish people in order to confront the separatist counter-revolutionary groups in Kurdistan. The relations and connection that preceded the establishment of the Muslim Kurdish Peshmerga. The Peshmerga were made up of Kurdish people who fought for the ideals of the Islamic Revolution against these separatist counter-revolutionary groups. On November the 26th, the Imam issued a decree to establish the Organization for Mobilization of the Oppressed, or the Basij Organization. In early 1980, almost a year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the first presidential elections were held. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr was elected. He openly opposed the approach of the Islamic Republic Party, of which Ayatollah Khamenei was one of the founders. Ayatollah Khamenei resigned from his military post on the 24th of February, 1980.
The Persian New Year in 1980 began with increased threats of aggression by the Ba'athist regime of Iraq. But at the same time, the Carter administration in the U.S. was threatening the Islamic Republic after severing ties with Iran. In an interview with Pars News Agency on April the 9th of 1980, Ayatollah Khamenei considered this coincidence as a sign of Saddam's dependence on the U.S. But at that point, no one knew how close this analysis was to reality. The first indication of the correctness of this analysis came on the morning of the 25th of April 1980. Early that day, Mohammad Muntazir Qaim, commander of the Yazd IRGC, heard suspicious reports about an area in Tabas Desert, so he went to the area to investigate. In the middle of Tabas Desert, the U.S. military equipment and a number of corpses that belonged to American soldiers were found. It soon became known that the United States had plotted to attack Tehran the previous night to free the American spies, but a sandstorm had ruined their plans. The reports about the Tabas incident worried and concerned the imam. And what made matters even more suspicious was that after the Americans fled, some commanders decided to bomb American equipment left behind in Tabas. In this bombing, Mohammad Muntazir Qaim, commander of the Yazd IRGC, was martyred. On May the 19th of 1980, the imam appointed Ayatollah Khamenei and Dr. Mustafa Chamran as his representatives in the Supreme National Defense Council, which was the highest decision-making body in the country's military affairs and was chaired by President Banisadr himself. In this new ruling, the imam had instructed Ayatollah Khamenei to report to him on the state of the army every week. That is why Ayatollah Khamenei set up the military advisory office. In Tehran, everything seemed calm. On the night of July the 9th of 1980, however, the presence of a stranger at Ayatollah Khamenei's house disturbed that peace. An Air Force pilot came to Ayatollah Khamenei's door with important news. An infiltration network inside the army led from abroad by Shapur Bakhtiar, the Shah's last prime minister, had plotted a major coup. The IRGC forces were able to obtain clues about the infiltration, but its dimensions were still unclear. What had become evident was that they were planning to bomb the imam's residence in Jamoran and conduct a coup. Other major centers, such as the Islamic Consultative Assembly, the Presidency Office, and the main headquarters of the Army and the IRGC, had also been targeted by the coup plotters. Ayatollah Khamenei conveyed the matter to other officials in the country, including the imam himself. In a quick operation, the coup network was identified and the coup leaders and members were arrested. The confessions revealed that the coup meetings had started right after Ayatollah Khamenei left the army. In the summer of that year, the Iraqi border attacks by Saddam became very evident. The warning arrows were now approaching their main target. The shadow of war was so close that everyone could feel it. However, the president paid no attention to issues regarding the defense of the country. He did not even hold meetings of the Supreme Defense Council, even while Iraq's border encroachments on Iran were on the rise. The total number of Saddam border encroachments recorded at the UN is 636. Just a few days before the start of Saddam's large-scale invasion of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei used the Friday prayer sermon to send a message of confidence and morale to the armed forces. In addition to this influential scene, Ayatollah Khamenei also witnessed the oppression of the country's military. Military personnel and soldiers who were the target of the MKO and Marxist guerrillas' intense propaganda. On September the 22nd of 1980, Ayatollah Khamenei had returned to the General Factory where he had spent the moment of the victory of the revolution. Little did he know that this time his presence would be tied to yet another monumental moment in Iranian history. He waited in a room for the workers to gather in the lecture hall, but suddenly the doors and the walls began to shake. On that day, Ayatollah Khamenei personally saw the fighter jets attacking Tehran's international airport. Saddam's regime, with the support of Western countries, had dared to attack revolutionary Iran, a nationwide attack that was now the beginning of a new chapter for the military service of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei.
On September the 22nd of 1980, the day the Ba'athist regime invaded Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei was at the General Factory. There, he decided to go to the Army's Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters. They were waiting for him there. But this time, not in the usual buildings, he was taken to the war room. Everyone was in the war room. At that moment, it was reported that 10 or 12 other airports in the country had been bombed. The meeting was filled with commotion. Ayatollah Khamenei asked the then commander of the Air Force, Colonel Fakhouri, why they had not taken any defensive action. Enemy planes should not have been allowed to come to Tehran without being intercepted. Fakhouri had no answer. At that moment, all the commanders were worried. Ayatollah Khamenei suggested that if the military commanders were so worried, the people must be even more concerned, and the first task of this council should be to give morale to the people. Everyone welcomed the idea. They unanimously asked Ayatollah Khamenei to write a message in his own pen and to read the message to the Iranian people on the radio in his own voice. This voice reached the people's homes in those moments of fear and distress. That same night, Imam Khomeini's first message was broadcast on the Islamic Republic of Iran radio and television. The fact was that, as ordered by the Imam, the Air Force was preparing for a tough response to Saddam's regime. On September the 23rd of 1980, about 140 Iranian fighter jets under the command of Colonel Fakhouri bombed enemy targets. Ayatollah Khamenei received the report of the operation, and as a member of parliament, he immediately went to the parliament building to convey the news to the people's representatives in a speech before his order. But the deputy chief of staff of the army, Brigadier General Fallahi, as well as commander of the air force, Colonel Fakhouri, also had some bad news. Ayatollah Khamenei was told that the air operation could continue for a maximum of 30 more days, after which all Iranian planes would gradually become non-operational one by one. Reports from Fakhouri said that all of these planes, which were maintained by American technicians prior to the revolution, will quickly become non-operational in the course of the war, and that spare parts could not be purchased due to U.S. hostility. Ayatollah Khamenei was supposed to convey this news to Imam Khomeini. The Imam, however, was very calm in the face of this news and announced that there would be no problems and that the Air Force would be able to continue flying after these 30 days. The confidence of the Imam boosted Ayatollah Khamenei's morale. At this critical juncture, UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim is calling for a ceasefire on both sides of the conflict. Chairman of the UN Security Council, Tayyip Salim, on behalf of the members of the council, wants both sides to end the war. Secretary General of the Islamic Conference, Habib Chatti, also called for immediate ceasefire. None of them acknowledge the fact that Iran has been invaded by Saddam's regime and is defending itself, while the Ba'athist army is invading and has occupied Iran's territory. In the first 5 days of the war, 20,000 kilometers of the country's territory was occupied by the enemy. During the sermons of the Friday prayers of the September the 26th, Ayatollah Khamenei announced that the United States was the director behind the scene in the war. Although Ayatollah Khamenei was the Friday prayer leader of Tehran, the representative of the people of Tehran in the parliament, the representative of the Imam in the Supreme Defense Council, and the head of the Imam's advisory office in the army, he was very eager to be present on the war front. Finally, September the 27th,
arrived. At 9 o'clock in the morning, Bani Sadr came to Imam Khomeini to give the worst possible news. The maximum resistance of the army against the enemy was only 1 week, he predicted, and after that, there was no more ammunition. He presented the report within only 15 minutes and then hurried away from the imam under the pretext of welcoming the president of Pakistan, who was scheduled to arrive in Tehran at 4:30 p.m. At 10:30, the rest of the country's officials and commanders gathered with the imam. On that day, the imam announced that surrender was simply not an option and that the defense would continue as long as Iranian territory was in the hands of the enemy. The imam said that even if the enemy enters the cities of Iran, people will continue to resist. This was Imam's explicit opinion about the war, which provided a good opportunity to fulfill Ayatollah Khamenei's wish, that is, joining the front. He went to see the imam and asked for his permission. Seeing this scene, Dr. Chamran also decided to accompany Ayatollah Khamenei. Outside the imam's house, Ayatollah Khamenei suggested to Chamran that they go to the front together. Dr. Chamran asked for a few hours. They decided to meet each other at Tehran's Mehrabad airport. During this time, Ayatollah Khamenei returned home. He wanted to go to the battlefield in the next few hours, where it could be a point of no return. Some of the bodyguards insisted on going with him. Ayatollah Khamenei agreed on the condition that when they got there, they would abandon his protection and join the war. He went to Mehrabad with the guards. Chamran had also arrived. There was a group of about 50 people, all volunteers for guerrilla and irregular warfare. Their plane took off in the afternoon and flew to Ahvaz. The evening of that day, they landed in complete darkness on the runway of Ahvaz Airport and then went to the place where the headquarters of the city's armored division was located. The commanders did not have good news. It was clear that the enemy was only 12 kilometers away from reaching the city of Ahvaz, the heart of Khuzestan province. If Ahvaz fell, Khuzestan would be lost. The situation of the defense forces in Ahvaz was disappointing and they were not ready for any operation. The first task that Ayatollah Khamenei felt was necessary at that moment was to organize the Ahvaz defense forces. A decision had to be made. Dr. Chamran had also decided to go and identify the enemy. The guerrilla forces that came with Dr. Chamran were getting prepared. It was at that moment that Ayatollah Khamenei decided to go toward the enemy tanks with Chamran. It was in the last hours of the night of September the 27th, 1980, that Ayatollah Khamenei went to the front line with Chamran's forces. In the darkness of the night, they advanced a little and then had to walk. After a short walk, they reached a point where the sound of a tank could be heard. It turned out that they were only 500 meters away from the enemy's base. Chamran, who identified the area, ordered the troops to return. It was early in the morning when they reached the barracks of the 92nd Division in Ahvaz. The military personnel were both surprised and happy to see Ayatollah Khamenei in military uniform. In the morning of the same day, that is September the 28th of 1980, some military commanders came to Ayatollah Khamenei with an offer. If Iran dumped water in the plains of the western region of Ahvaz, the movement of the enemy's tanks would be impossible. Ayatollah Khamenei agreed, and preparations were made for an artificial flood against enemy tanks. But there were other issues as well. Ayatollah Khamenei and Chamran set up the irregular warfare headquarters. Popular forces and nomads from all over the country registered in his headquarters to go to the front and defend the country. But regulating the work of this headquarters required the selection, training, and the adoption of security measures. Under the supervision of Ayatollah Khamenei, Colonel Salimi was put in charge of the headquarters. the command of the forces was also given to Dr. Chamron. On the 29th of September, bad news arrived. The enemy was approaching Ahvaz from Hamidiye. Hamidiye was located 23 kilometers from Ahvaz, and the enemy was only 5 kilometers from Ahvaz on the 29th of September, nearing the city from Hamidiye Road. There was no time to hesitate. The Imam had sent a message. Are the young people of Ahvaz dead? This message increased the presence of the people to defend the city. On September the 30th, the head of the Khuzestan Water and Electricity Organization reviewed and approved a plan to release water in the south of Hamidiye. The plan was immediately implemented under Ayatollah Khamenei's command at the Irregular Warfare Headquarters. The plains of the area were suddenly flooded. The water subsided after a while, but the enemy tanks were stuck. As night fell, a group of 40 IRGC members prepared for an operation that was to take place that night. Ali Qayyur was in charge of the operation. He was trained as an Air Force Special Force in Germany and Italy. He joined the IRGC when the revolution took place and took over the military training of the Revolutionary Guards.
The limelight. There is only inquiry as part of a larger effort by Republicans to undermine faith in the 2020 election and gain more control over the voting process. So far this year, at least 18 Republican-led states have passed legislation curbing ballot access, moves they claim are needed to ensure election integrity. Democrats say such laws are aimed at gaming the system, since Republicans tend to do better in low turnout elections. We now present you an article written jointly by David Schwartz and Nathan Lane. The piece is titled "Trump Dealt Blow as Republican-led Arizona Audit Reaffirms Biden Win." The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. Review of results by Donald Trump's allies in the Republican Party has reaffirmed he lost the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden in Arizona's most populous county, capping a widely panned effort spurred by Trump's false claims over voter fraud. Arizona Senate President Karen Fann, the Republican who paved the way for the so-called full forensic audit of 2.1 million ballots in Maricopa County, Arizona, said the review's overall vote tally matched the initial results in November. At a Senate hearing on the review, which found only small variations yielding 99 additional votes for Joe Biden and 261 fewer votes for Donald Trump, Karen Fann said, "Truth is truth. Numbers are numbers. Those numbers were close, within a few hundred." The conclusion will dismay Donald Trump's supporters who had pushed for the review, many in the expectation that it would prove his unfounded assertions that he was robbed of re-election due to orchestrated fraud. So far, no such proof has been produced either by Donald Trump or his backers. Outside groups tied to the Stop the Steal movement and other efforts to cast doubt on the 2020 election results raised nearly all of the $6 million to fund the inquiry, viewing it as a catalyst for similar investigations in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and other battleground states that Donald Trump lost. Thank you. Texas. Meanwhile, on Thursday, 23rd of September, the Secretary of State's office said the state had begun an audit of the presidential election in its four largest counties. That is Dallas, Harris, Tarrant, and Collin. An announcement that came hours after Donald Trump publicly called for such a move. Although Trump carried Texas, Joe Biden won three of the targeted counties. Donald Trump, who had predicted the Arizona inquiry would substantiate his claims, issued a statement that appeared at odds with the review's findings, calling it a big win for democracy and a big win for us. Ben Ginsburg, a longtime Republican election lawyer who represented Republican George W. Bush when he prevailed over Democrat Al Gore in a 2000 electoral dispute, called the review's conclusions a huge defeat for former U.S. President Donald Trump.